hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, A-N-A-C-O-O-L, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.
Your weekend is not complete without the First Lady of New York Radio. It's the Joan Hamburg Show, Talk Radio 77 WABC.
I'm very sad because one of my favorite shows, Curb Your Enthusiasm, says that the last show is coming up. Now, it's interesting how I never thought I would be addicted to TV shows, ever. But I can't resist this show. It makes me, I don't know what it makes me. I mean, why am I so enthralled with a show about very cranky people? But
because it's funny.
Because it's really funny. And Susie Essman, the star, knows what's funny. She's been doing funny since she was a kid and didn't do what her mother wanted her to do, marry a rich man immediately. You chose your own path.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's what everybody has to do. Yeah. Anybody I know that has married for other reasons than because this is going to be a great partner for your life has not been happy. You know it. We've seen it.
Yeah. But we all resisted it. You resisted it, too.
But, you know, I used to have, I can't say it on the air, I used to have this bit in my act about, you know, there's the paper. Everybody's looking for what's on paper. He's this, he's that, he's that. And I had this bit in my act where I used to say, my husband was horrible on paper when I first met him. He had four kids. He lived 150 miles away. He didn't have a lot of money. But you know what? You can't sleep with paper. I cleaned that up.
I know. That's a funny bit. That's a funny bit. Oh, my gosh, what a crazy world we live in. But your career, when we think about it, really, has evolved from stand-up, which to me sounds so terrifying. I don't know how you guys do it, but you do it. And you've been doing it since you were just a wee girl.
No, 28. I started at 28. So I was a little bit older than it. Like so many people, you know, started it in college, 18, 19. I don't know what they had to talk about at that age, quite honestly. You know, I think you got to get a little bit of life under you before you have something to say on stage. But I was a little bit older. I was a late bloomer. And I haven't done
funny?
It for about 6-7 years. Oh, yeah. I was always funny. And I was always, you know, in school, I wasn't the class clown. I would be funny with my girlfriend, you know. But I was always the one that would say, you know, like if they, you know, they would have me ask the teacher, can we go outside today or whatever? I was always the big mouth is what I was.
Right. And you weren't scared.
Whatever everybody else wanted to say, but wouldn't say it. Yeah, I wasn't scared. I wasn't scared. You know, it's a favor that my father did for me because he was very anti-authority. You know, he was quite rebellious himself. So he taught me that about authority, except that I had to obey his authority. That was the only one that he cared about. But
right,
for the rest of the world, I was able to thumb my nose at authority.
And you did it. But at what point does someone like you decide this is going to be my life? You know, this is not just me entertaining the girls after work.
Well, I think it was I went through my 20s were very, very difficult for me. And that first year out of college is difficult for a lot of people because your life is so regimented. You know what you're doing all the time up until that point. And then all of a sudden, it's like, what am I supposed to do now? I don't have school anymore. And I went into a very bad downward spiral when I graduated and could not figure out what I was taking acting classes at HB Studio and at Stella Adler. And I just found them so boring and not interesting. And I thought, okay, that's what I thought I wanted. And it wasn't until friends forced me at 28 to get up on stage that I found, I had no idea that that's what I wanted to do. I thought I wanted to be more like a Carol Burnett, you know, sketch comedy.
Right.
Stand up never occurred to me. Because when I was growing up, Joan, and you know this, we would see the only stand-up we saw was on Ed Sullivan every Sunday
exactly,
night.
Exactly, where we all had to gather around.
Yeah, and because there was three channels. And that was the joke tellers. You know, it was Joan Rivers, and it was Alan King, and it was Jackie Mason, and, you know, and they would tell jokes, and that didn't connect to me at all. I never thought that that was something that I wanted to do. It wasn't really until I saw Richard Pryor that I thought, oh, that's different. That's something that maybe would interest me. You know, it was a different style that started to come up with Robert Klein and yeah. Pryor that started to come up, and it was a different kind of a delivery. But friends forced me to get on stage. And then after a few months of doing it, I was like, okay, this is what I was born to do. But it wasn't something that I ever thought of doing.
That which is amazing. So it evolved. And yeah. When you started, were you at places like the Improv or
I never worked the Improv. I started Joy Behar, who's we share as a very close friend.
Right.
We met at this place called Comedy U, which was downtown on University and 13th Street. It was over a Mexican restaurant, this tiny little club. And the owners were these great guys, Burt Levitt and Paul Herzog, who were incredibly supportive of female comics. And they had a Thursday night female comedy night, which now sounds like nothing. But at that time,
it was
a big deal. It was a big deal because women, when you would go to the Uptown clubs, which were the Improv, Catch a Rising Star, the Comic Strip, they would put up a lineup. They would only allow one woman per lineup. It would be all male comics and one woman. They would not have two women on a lineup. So you didn't have the opportunity to get a lot of stage time. But these guys were so supportive of women. They had a women comedy night. They put up four women in a lineup on a weekend. They didn't follow that rule. So Joy and I both really developed a lot there because we got a lot of stage time and a lot of support. And after a while, I think we both realized you have to go to the Uptown clubs because that's where the business was. You know, that's where you were going to be seen in the business and move along. So I just worked at Comedy U for the first 6 months of my career, which was amazing. And then I ventured out. I never worked at the Improv. I was a Catch a Rising Star on the Comic Strip. It's the rest is herstory.
Right. But it was amazing how it started to really catch on. And you were there now going along with this ride.
Yeah. If you recall, the mid-80s, which is when I started working, it was a comedy boom in Manhattan. I mean, every single night at Catch a Rising Star, there would be lines around the block on a Monday night, you know. It was like the hottest thing to do. And it was a tiny room, but it was. And every night there were celebrities in the audience. You know, I'd be on stage and I'd look out and I would see David Bowie or Warren Beatty or, you know, whoever. It was a hot place to be, Catch a Rising Star in the 80s. And careers were made. And that's where I met Larry David.
Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, Anacool, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.
And was it hard, you know, over the years, was it hard then to make people laugh? Or is it always the same kind of things that work?
You know, I, having not done it in a number of years since all this political correctness has taken over in comedy, I don't know what it's like now. I speak to friends of mine, Judy Gold, for example, who still does a lot of stand-up, hilariously funny. And she says she doesn't pay attention. She just does whatever she wants. And if people want to complain, they can complain. But when for all those years that I was in clubs, it was private. People didn't have cell phones. They weren't taping you. They weren't tweeting or Xing while you were on stage and telling people what you were saying. So it was a place where you could really grow and push the envelope, you know, and see where the line, you have to cross the line sometimes to know where the line was. So creatively, it was a great kind of incubation place, the comedy clubs in the 80s and 90s, that I don't know if it still is. I don't know if you're allowed to be bad anymore. And I think for any artist, you need to be allowed to be bad in order to get better.
Right. And is it like you talk about being bad? What does that mean? Does that mean the material doesn't really work or?
Yeah. Yeah, or you try something and it bombs. But you have to try it before you. The thing about stand-up, which is so scary, is you really can't do it in your bathroom mirror. And you can't do it in the living room with your friends. It has to be on a stage with strangers. And that's terrifying. But that's the only place you're going to find out if your material works or not. Mm. And you got to try new stuff. And sometimes something doesn't work, and then you hone it, you try it again the next night a little differently. Rodney used to be famous for removing words. You know, he was a brilliant joke writer. So he always knew that the shorter it was, the better. And he would come to Catch a Rising Star, and he'd sit at the bar, and he was so supportive of all the young comedians. And he would go over everybody's material, and he'd say something like, take this word out here and that word out there, and the joke will work. And he was almost always right. You know, he had a rhythm in his head. But you have to be willing to try new stuff and be bad in order to figure out what's going to work. And even, you know, I mentioned Richard Pryor before. Before I ever did stand up, my cousin Michael Pressman, who's a director, and he had just directed Pryor in a movie called Some Kind of Hero. And I was in L.A. visiting him, and he took me to the Comedy Store to see Pryor. And he was workshopping a new special. And some of the stuff died. You know, some of the stuff, he was figuring it out. And that was the first time I realized, oh, you don't have to have it all figured out. You work it. You could be bad. Because if even Pryor, who was so brilliant, had stuff that wasn't working, was bad, it was revelatory to me. Mm.
And to really get a market and be good at it, do you have to write? Like you, I know you can write and you write a lot of your own stuff. Do most successful comics do that?
I think, yeah. I mean, in the old days, your Bob Hopes and those guys all had joke writers. But they were telling jokes. Then comedy evolved into something more personal and more storytelling. So I can't imagine, I mean, somebody could give me a punchline here and there, but I can't imagine anybody really writing for me because it's so personal.
Uh-huh.
You know, almost everyone I know writes their own material.
Well, that's interesting. My kid, who's involved in the world of comedy.
And he's a wonderful writer. Well, he gives some of his credits.
He keeps a little pad, a notebook, and he's constantly jotting things down. You know, after a while, I stopped talking to him because he would write all this stuff down.
Yeah, that's what Larry did for years. Larry always had a little notebook in his pocket. And he would constantly write ideas down. And sometimes those ideas would show up, you know, four or five seasons later.
That's funny.
But yeah.
How did you know Larry?
I knew Larry because I met him at Catch a Rising Star in the mid-80s, where he was a stand-up comic. And he was, you know, there working like the rest of us. And he used to hang out at the bar with me and Joy and tell us all his dating tales of woe. He had many tales of woe. Hey,
well, that's his whole persona.
Life.
Was he funny or was he depressed?
No, he was always funny. He was always funny. But all those stories ended up being George Costanza storylines.
Oh.
All the stories he would tell us of all his dating problems would end up, the character George took them all on. No, he was always funny. He was, the audience didn't always get him. He was never a panderer to the audience, but his material was brilliant. But if I said to everybody, all the comics hanging out at Catch a Rising Star in 1986, Larry David's going to be richer and more famous than all of us,
they'd laugh.
Nobody would have believed it. Yeah.
I
he
know.
Wasn't that kind of guy. He didn't have that kind of an ambition.
No, and he always looked like such an unhappy guy, like, what am I doing here?
Well, he was a guy like he'd be on stage killing and, you know, one woman in the audience would look at her watch and that would be it. He'd just storm off. That would be enough to throw him. But he's he's calmed down now in his old age.
Well, he's more secure.
Yeah, well, you know, success can do that to you.
Yeah. Has success changed your life a lot?
I was reading an article yesterday in the New York Times about happiness and money.
Yeah.
And, you know, people always say money can't buy happiness. And that's true. However, money can make your life a whole lot more comfortable.
Exactly. Can make the misery more palatable.
Yeah. So, success has changed me in the sense that I feel a lot more secure. You know, in the beginning, we were all so poor. I mean, we'd work on a weeknight at the clubs. You'd get $7-$8 a show.
Is that it?
Yeah, they'd call it cab fare. And you tried to go to a club where they would feed you sometimes. You know, some clubs had food. Right. So that would be like a bonus. But we were all, you know, I mean, we were all struggling, really struggling. Larry, Joy, I mean, we all were financially. So having more money is, it makes life easier. But also having success, I think, validates you in a certain way that I don't know how to explain it really, but you feel that you accomplished what you wanted to accomplish.
Right.
And that feels good.
But when you reach a certain point like that, you know, look what I've done, look what I'm doing. Is that enough, or are you always peeking over the edge to see what's next?
Well, I still have a creative urge. So I don't, what's interesting is it, part of the reason why I stopped doing stand-up, there was a number of reasons, but part of the reason was that I no longer had the need of the audience's love, which I think I once had. That just kind of, you know, I figured that out and I didn't really need it as much. Mm-hmm. But there's always a desire for creativity.
Right. And,
you know, there's always a desire to, if you're a creative, it's, you bring this up and it's, I'm sorry, I don't know if you could hear those beeps. It's Carol Leifer calling me on the other line. you know, Richard Lewis, my darling friend who died recently.
I know, it's so sad.
So sad. But I spoke with him just a few weeks before he died. And he was telling me, because of the Parkinson's, and he was in such infirm shape, which you could see when you see this season on Curb, what bad shape he was in. He was telling me how frustrated he was because his body was no longer allowing him to be creative. Mm-hmm. He couldn't do stand-up anymore. He couldn't write. He had so many motor issues, motor skills issues. And it was incredibly frustrating for him because that's who he was. He was a comic and he needed to express it. And he couldn't any longer. And that to me was even sadder in a way than him dying.
Yeah, that is, you know, you look at people's lives and their stories and everyone has one. And it really does, it puts a curtain over a lot of things. Do you always worry that you'll run out of ideas or
Always. And every time I would get on stage, I would be like, oh, fooled them again.
Did you always feel relief when you were finished doing a set?
Yes. Tremendous relief. Yeah, tremendous relief. Tremendous anxiety before I went on. I mean, I really suffered from severe stage fright. But then once I stood on the stage, I was completely relaxed. Once I grabbed that mic, I had no fear whatsoever. But when it was done, it was like, oh, God.
Yeah, you couldn't.
You know, I used to always say, I'm going to do this before I would go on. I'm going to do this tonight and I'm never going to do it again.
And that would be a comfort almost. You know, if I get through this, that's it.
That's it. But of course it wasn't, because you also get quite addicted to the laughs.
Right, I'm sure.
You get very addicted to the laughs.
And if you don't get that laugh, you keep pushing it, or do you go to another laugh?
It depends on what the bit is. I would tend to go move on. Other comics I know would be, you know, Gilbert Gottfried was notorious for being relentless. If he wasn't getting what he wanted, he would just have like a repetition going. I'd just say it over and over and over again to the point of like it was psychotic. But I would always just move on. I would just move on.
And just cut, go do the next.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, look, I had a very high ratio of doing well. But sometimes there's nothing you could do. Sometimes you just have an audience and you're rifling through that file card in your head, trying to figure out a way, you know, every possible way to get them, and you just can't.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine what that's like to look at all those faces and feel that anxiety.
It feels pretty bad.
Yeah. Maybe at least it isn't fattening. You've got to look at the pluses. and figure out. And when you hang out with comic friends, and almost all your friends are funny or comic, yeah. Do you work on stuff together or?
Not anymore. We used to do that. You know, we used to, it's all kind of different now, but we used to do our sets and we'd finish at like 2 o'clock in the morning and then we'd all go to the diner and then you would go over your stuff, like what worked, what didn't work, suggestions to this, suggestions, you know, it used to be very communal in that way, but not so much anymore.
No. And do you still all hang out together or not? It's all part of that.
Yeah, not in the same way that we used to, because it used to be your social life was going to the clubs. You'd walk into Catch a Rising Star. You knew everybody. All your friends were the comics hanging out at the bar. You knew the waiters and waitresses and the bartenders and the door people. And it was cheers. You know, it was your cheers. So it was kind of ready-made. You know, all those years I didn't have a boyfriend, I didn't have to think about a date on a Saturday night or New Year's Eve. I was working.
Right.
You know,
and it was always an excuse for the relatives. Like, why doesn't Susie have someone if she's working?
She's working. And I enjoyed it. I didn't really, you know, miss that. But sometimes, but not most of the time. But now I have a lot of friends who are comics, but we don't all hang out together in the same way. But that is one thing I'm going to miss about working on Curb. Because I mentioned Carol Leifer was just calling me on the other phone. She was one of our producers. I'd walk on set and there would be Carol Leifer and Larry and
right,
John
all
Heyman.
All those faces that are part of your
all the
life.
People that I've known for so many years and that I've worked with for so many
right,
years.
Grown up
and
with
was,
them.
Right. And it was family. It was family to hang out on set. And, you know, you're working 12, 15 hours a day. You spend a lot of time with each other. You eat two meals together, three. I'll definitely miss that camaraderie and the sense of community of working on the show with this particular group of people.
And
especially
what
that.
Is it when you look back and think how this era may be coming to a close? What is it that enabled Curb to keep on no matter what and keep all of us wanting more?
Well, that's Larry. I mean, that is purely Larry. It's his vision. You know, we're all just cogs in the wheel of his brilliance, mm-hmm. I think. I mean, an important cogs. I'm not discounting what all of us offer, but it's his vision. It's his humor. It's his vision. And it's so unique and so original. And he's so true to it. You know, like he never gave in to any political correctness or any pressure or any notes from the network, nothing. He has so much integrity about his comedic vision. And I think that that's why it survived all these years. And if you go back and look at the early episodes, I would say 95% of them hold up.
Yeah.
From 24 years ago.
They do. And it's how often, as an audience person or someone observing, do you laugh out loud? And that's what happens when you watch it. You just yeah. sit there laughing like a jerk because it's
and
your
don't
life.
Don't we need that? We need that?
We do need it, absolutely, more than ever. And we need funny and comedy and people who know how to do stand-up.
Well, Larry will do something else. I'll do something else. We're all going to move on to something else. But this experience of this particular show was so unique. I'll never do anything like that again. And have the experience of being a part, being a creative voice in that way, because I write my own lines. I had so much creative input onto that show, which I don't know that I'll ever have again, but that's okay. Everything has to change.
I know, but we all need it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's hard to believe it's the final season. And so many things, well, we're not going to even tell people if they haven't been watching it on a regular basis, now's the time to start in. But it deals with everything that we all deal with in life, only they really make you laugh at it very hard. And there's a comedic sensibility that sort of helps us get through the day.
And thank you, Joan. I'm glad for that.
No, but it is. It's not easy to laugh at stuff, but that just makes you breathe and just crack up over everything that we live through and happens to us. So now you're going to have to come up with another Sunday deal.
All right. I'm working on it. I got a couple of irons in the fire that
maybe
I can't talk
you should
about,
do
but
Broadway
I'm working
on
it.
Too hard?
8 shows a week.
Yeah, but there's a huge need when you think for that. And
well, my girlfriend's going to fill that gap.
Wait, do I know her?
Yes, you do.
she's got a lot on her plate. And as
Joy
you
is
do.
A very, very funny playwright. Very funny playwright. And, last November, we did a production of her 5 short plays called Bonkers in the Burrows. And it was great. It was really, really great. I was in it. She was in it. Jackie Hoffman.
Yeah, we loved it.
Renee Taylor. You know, I mean, she had a really great cast put together. Danny Hock, Bob Ari, just a really bunch of great people. I'm leaving people out and I'm sorry.
Yeah, but they're there. We know.
But she's this is her third act as a playwright, I think.
Okay, well, we've got a lot to look forward to. Thank you, Susie.
Thank you, Joan. Hope to see you soon.
I look forward to it. We'll talk. I'm Joan Hamburg. That's Susie Essman. And we've got lots more here on WABC. Stay tuned.
Hemorrhoids can be a real pain in the butt, causing anal itching and burning and irritation. Get fast relief with all-natural, doctor-developed and tested Anacool. Buy Anacool, Anacool, on Amazon right now and save 15% with code WABC2024.